From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. If you blog or tweet as part of your job, when you leave, does the Twitter account and the list of followers belong to you or to your employer? That's a question underlying a lawsuit that may establish a precedent in the online world related to ownership of social media accounts. And we'll find out all about it and take up the issue in the hour ahead. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Social networking is the top online global activity. Nearly one in every 5 minutes, someone is availing him or herself to an online social network. And in October, Twitter reached 1 in 10 internet users worldwide. Can you put a price on a tweet or on a Twitter follower or, for that matter, any social media material? An Oakland employee of the mobile phone site PhoneDog.com, Noah Kravitz, quit his job as a reviewer and video blogger for the interactive mobile company. He had built up a Twitter account of some 17,000 followers under the name of the company and says he was assured by them that he could keep his Twitter account in exchange for occasional plugs on their behalf. 8 months later, in a U.S. District Court in Northern California, the company sued for damages of $340,000, claiming that the Twitter list was a customer list. We take up the ongoing controversy in this forum hour. Joining us in studio is Noah Kravitz. He's now editor-at-large with TechnoBuffalo.com, former PhoneDog.com employee. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have here in studio with us Tom McInerney, partner with Ogletree Deacons, a national labor and employment specialty law firm, and not the former mayor of San Jose, but the mayor presently of San Anselmo. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We also have Eric Goldman with us by phone, who's associate professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law and directs the High Tech Law Institute. And Eric Goldman, welcome to the program. Do we have Eric Goldman? Okay, I believe we do, but we will say hello to him when we have him online here. Let me begin with you, Noah Kravitz, and let's get let me just lay out for listeners what we're talking about here. The suit that was against you, and we should mention that you're also suing for back pay.
Correct.
But the suit against you by PhoneDog, your former employer, talks about misappropriation of trade secrets, interference with economic advantage, and conversion, which I guess has to do with, trade secrets and, again, account names, passwords, things of that sort. This came as a real surprise to you, a shock to you.
I'm learning quite a bit about the law as we go here. I left As you said, Michael, I left the job back in October of 2010. Unfortunately, a dispute over my contract, over some money that I felt and still feel I'm owed, ensued. And I wound up having to seek legal counsel, eventually retain a litigator and file a complaint. And so this all went on until about July of this year, so about 8 months later. We were in the process of filing our complaint and serving them with papers for my employment dispute case. And it was a Sunday night. I was at home in Oakland. Car drove up. Man got out, knocked on the door, and said those words you hear in the movies: "You've been served." So the Twitter case was, as you said, it was a complete surprise to me. Not, I guess, surprising that they would retaliate, for leverage purposes, whatever the purpose is. I don't want to speculate in some way. But the Twitter claim was very surprising, to say the least.
And they were saying that you owed them $340,000 because, I guess this figure is $2.50 a month per follower for those 8 months that you mentioned?
Yes. They based it on the number of followers I had at the time that I left the company, which they say is 17,000. As you said, times 250 per follower per month for the 8 months that had lapsed until they filed suit.
This is the notion that Twitter followers represent a customer list, but Twitter follower list is public, isn't it? I mean, it's available to anyone.
Yeah, you can go to twitter.com/Noah Kravitz or slash anybody else And you'll see, you know, it's pretty clear there the number of followers that an account has. Click on it. You'll get a list of all the followers. I don't even think you have to be logged in as a Twitter user to see the follower list. They're publicly available.
But they didn't ask you for that list when you said you were leaving. And they said, in effect, that you could use it. And this makes it a far more complicated case, I suppose.
I understand, you know, the reason that I'm here and it's getting some attention is because there are, important and potentially far-reaching ramifications. But on the personal level of my case, it comes down to, you know, we had agreed, you have a breakup and you divvy up the assets, right? And so I had some equipment that they'd bought for me to use. I sent it back.
But an amicable divorce.
Amicable divorce, exactly. Right? If you go to the site and you look at, I had a farewell post that they asked me to write and I wrote, or whoever asked me to write, I wrote, they submitted it to them. They published it the Monday after my official last day of work. There was also a video I did because we gained a little bit of notoriety in our little corner of the media world for doing technology videos on YouTube. So there's also a video. These both ran on Monday, October 18th of 2010, which was the Monday after my last official day of employment. So they published the post, both of which direct people, hey, I don't know what I'm up to next exactly, but if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Noah Kravitz. So they knew.
So you dropped the phone dog name.
So I dropped the phone dog name. They knew that. We'd talked about it. Everything was fine. The account's yours. Would you mind tweeting, on our behalf from time to time? Perhaps naively, looking back naively, I said, yeah, of course. We had 5 years together, and I support
But from
you
your perspective, you held up your side of the bargain.
Absolutely.
And Noah Kravitz, editor-at-large now with TechnoBuffalo.com and formerly with PhoneDog.com. We asked PhoneDog.com if they would be on the program. They declined to comment, except for this statement, and I'll read it verbatim. The costs and resources invested by PhoneDog Media into growing its followers, fans, and general brand awareness through social media are substantial and are considered property of PhoneDog Media, LLC. We intend to aggressively protect our customer lists and confidential information, intellectual property, trademark, and brands. I believe we do now have Eric Goldman with us. Are you there, Eric Goldman?
Yes, I am.
And again, Eric Goldman is associate professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law and directs the High Tech Law Institute. And this gets into employer-employee relationships big time, but it also really has a lot to do with privacy online. And would it be advisable to take care in using your company's name if you're tweeting?
Well, certainly when an employee speaks on behalf of the company, they're making some very legally significant statements. So it's always in the employee's interest as well as the company's interest to make sure that they're coordinating their actions. But here we have a situation where the account was both corporate focused, but also very much a reflection of the individual employee. And many of the people who followed Noah were following because of the interest in what he had to say. And so in a situation like that, it becomes tricky to divide between the company's interest and the employee's interest.
What do we know in terms of precedent here? This may set a precedent itself. In fact, there's every indication that it probably will. But there are other cases. There's LinkedIn. There's Rick Sanchez, who worked for CNN, who got in a big flap, supposedly saying some anti-Semitic things about Jon Stewart. He kept his account. He changed the name of the account. In terms of case law, what do we have as far as a history here?
We have a few other cases that are similar to this where companies and employees are battling over social media accounts. But two things. None of them have reached a final conclusion. And second, and perhaps more importantly, each of them is entirely fact-specific. It depends a lot on who said what to whom and when. And so it's going to take a while for us to get, I think, very clear rules that aren't dependent on the specific facts of the cases. As a result, I think we are breaking some new ground here, trying to figure out where that line is.
Well, one of the newest grounds would seem to me is how do you determine how much a Twitter follower is worth or a LinkedIn subscriber is worth? And who owns the assets or the platform or the brand? Is it the employee?
Well, think about it this way. When a person follows another person on Twitter, they're saying, I want to hear what you have to say. Now, in the case of the account PhoneDog-Noah, that person might have been saying, I'm interested in what PhoneDog has to say. Chances are they were saying, I'm interested in what Noah has to say. And so when it's not as easy as a company saying, let's take that account back and just put in a new voice there. Instead of it being PhoneDog-Noah, it's actually going to be Jeff speaking as if he's phone dog Noah. People don't find that valuable at all. It's not a helpful substitution. So when thinking about what a Twitter follower is worth, we have to remember these people are mobile. They can drop a feed at any time. That cuts both directions. On the one hand, it means that they're worth almost nothing because they can leave at any time. On the other hand, it means that the fact that they're listening was something that they chose to do, and we have to try and figure out why.
I don't know who this Jeff guy is, but I don't like him one bit.
Eric Goldman with us, associate professor of Santa Clara University School of Law, directs the High Tech Law Institute. And what about JetBlue, Eric Goldman? They have an official policy not to respond to Twitter complaints, but they answer queries via Twitter.
In fact, many companies now are finding it valuable not only to have a presence on Twitter, but to actually engage their customers. It's created a whole new way for companies and customers to talk to each other. And companies are finding that's essential to building their brand, to supporting their loyal customers and winning over people who are on the fence. So in all cases, the people who are behind those Twitter accounts have their own unique personality. And it's not clear to me, again, just like in the Noah situation, how much that personality is really why people are listening in, or how much they're listening in because of the corporate affiliation.
Again, Eric Goldman with us by phone, associate professor at Santa Clara University School of Law and director of High Tech Law Institute. And Tom McInerney is here in studio, partner in Ogletree Deacons, National Labor and Employment Specialty Law Firm. And Your Honor, Mayor of San Anselmo, is the Twitter account intellectual property? Kind of boils down to that, doesn't it?
Well, like any good lawyer would say, I think the answer is it depends. It depends on the underlying facts. I mean, there's the underlying principle when you have an employee perform some work, does something on the job, there's the fundamental principle that that's a work for hire, that you're doing that work for your employer. But also the employment relationship is fundamentally contractual. So it depends on what your agreement is with your employer, what the company policies are. And if there are no policies and if it's unclear or ambiguous as to whether or not you're doing the postings while working, it makes it more difficult for an employer to argue that that's their property, that's their intellectual property. And, then you get into issues with if you have somebody that's posting maybe off work hours. Again, that makes it a little more complicated. If someone's tweeting at home or on weekends and the like, it's harder to argue. That's why these issues present a lot of challenges for employers, and it's a reason why there's sometimes abuse, or it can go beyond kind of what the expectations are of the employer and lead to some potentially serious employment issues that lead into areas of harassment or other potential liability issues for employers. And that's why you see employers really grappling with these issues with this as they face kind of this evolving technology and use of media.
Well, you mentioned outside of work, and I know at Yahoo they had all these instant messages going back and forth. Another interesting case, because it was a question of whether it was on the company server or not. It came down to that, didn't it?
It did. And we're seeing this a lot more, where you have employees that maybe have a system in place for sending instant messages, use it for work, and then maybe also use it for their own personal benefit, and maybe engaging in some banter off work and the like. And then there are claims later, either that these employees are saying, when I was tweeting off work, I was actually working, so I'm owed money for that time. Or there may be claims by other employees saying, I was harassed by some tweet from this other employee. And then you get in these issues with the employer saying, well, we're not liable for that. That was on off-duty work hours. It's a real kind of morass. So
it is a morass, and part of it has to do with the fact that the law in California on privacy is so unclear.
It is, absolutely.
Yeah, you were going to say something, Noah?
So is there a case to be made that PhoneDog owes me $250 per follower for the ones I accrued for them on non-business hours?
There's your countersuit.
And I'm working from Pacific time, but they're on Eastern time. So really, when are those hours? And when I was in Spain covering a mobile trade show, what are the business hours there?
It depends on that on underlying facts.
This is new territory we're in, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it gets also union concerns. You're talking about employer concerns, but union concerns too here.
You do. And there's issues dealing with the National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint earlier, you know, about a year or two ago where they employees were posting involving the issue of when employees post complaints about their employer and whether that is, quote unquote, concerted activity where they're trying to, you know, work in collaboration or in concert with their employees, and whether or not an employer can take employment action if somebody is bashing their employer, raising arguably invalid complaints or valid complaints. And that's where, you know, it raises a lot of difficulty for an employer in terms of, quote unquote, trying to control the message from these tweets.
I know there are many of you out there who have response to this particular case, but also questions or comments. And I'd like to open the phone lines now and invite you to join this conversation. In fact, you're cordially invited to do that right now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and it's available to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. You can join the program and are invited to do so. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or join us on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page, and we invite you to do that as well. Tom McInerney is a partner with Ogletree Deacons. He's here with us in studio. So is Noah Kravitz, editor-at-large now at technobuffalo.com and foreigner employee with phonedog.com. We're talking about the litigation. And Eric Goldman is associate professor at Santa Clara University School of Law and directs the High Tech Law Institute. And Eric Goldman, a lot of this boils down to social media accounts being at least seen by PhoneDog as being personal, like a Rolodex. I mean, when a company fires someone, many instances they say, turn in your Rolodex, right?
Customer lists have a venerable history as a trade secret. In fact, in many companies that are sales-focused, customer lists are among the most essential assets the company has. But it's we're not used to a situation where the company list, the customer lists are publicly available for anyone to see. And trying to fit that into the box of trade secrets is frankly illogical to me. It doesn't make any sense because, as Noah pointed out, you can go online and see the followers at any time. And in fact, you can contact them directly using Twitter tools without having to know the secret phone number or the secret email. So I think that it's anachronistic to think about customer lists as a trade secret, especially when they're published online.
Yeah, Noah Kravitz wanted in here. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say what's interesting and sort of ironic to me about all of this is that in the line of work that I was in, or I'm still in, with Techno Buffalo covering the high tech industry, the customer list, so to speak, to me was you know the Rolodex, if you will, all the contacts that I had built up in the industry. And this is an industry where I don't want to throw in the term access journalism, but a lot of this breaks on, you know, the case of the iPhone that came out last year, was found in a bar, you know, that whole to-do. Who can get their hands on something first? Who can get a scoop first? And so in our industry, with the mobile industry, a lot of times outlets will get a new product a couple weeks before it comes out, so we have a chance to review it and be one of the first on the block. With the review units. And so in this case, to me, the real key Rolodex isn't the public Twitter follower list, but it's all of my contacts in the PR industry I'd built up over time. In this case, PhoneDog considered me a contractor the whole time. In their lawsuit, they classify me as a contractor. And so whether I was or was not under obligation to share that Rolodex with them, I, of course, did, you know, throughout my time there. And they asked me for it before I left, and I passed it on to the now editor-in-chief who was slotting in. And so it's just very interesting to me to think, you know, the whole time, well, the secret here are the PR contacts. They're the ones who can
actually
really,
you're still
you
doing
know, do
PR
something.
For PhoneDog.
I know it's the irony of the thing, but you know what, I'm still friends with a couple of the people there, and I wish them the best. So, you know, enjoy the publicity.
Well, Tom McInerney, does all this maybe depend on why the account was open in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's certainly a factor. I mean, you have as I indicated before, the employment relationship really is driven by what the contractual relationship is of the parties. And if the Twitter account was set up and if there was an agreement that this was set up for purposes of facilitating and promoting PhoneDog, and that was the understanding of the parties, then that, you know, there's a strong argument that that is the property of PhoneDog.
But if it's your personal Twitter account and you're selling or advertising a brand or a product, it's still your personal account, isn't it?
It is, but it depends. You can still use other media, emails, LinkedIn, and other things to promote a product. And if it depends on if the even though that might be publicly available and it might have originally been your account, if the agreement was you'll use this account to promote a certain product, and you know, and then the parties can look at that agreement and that can kind of control what the value is that may be publicly available media is being used for.
And again, Tom McInerney is partner with Ogletree Deacons. You're going to say something, Noah Kravitz?
Well, one question I'd love to ask the lawyers in the room since they're here. How does Twitter play into all this? Because in the Twitter Terms of Service, and I don't have them in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing, but I believe the Twitter Terms of Service clearly state your account is the property of Twitter. This is a service. You're here to use it. But Twitter actually owns the account. So in that respect, how could anybody be claiming property?
Well, I can address that maybe putting on a litigator hat here if I were, say, taking the position of PhoneDog, which I'll preface that, you know, I don't represent PhoneDog and I'm not involved in this litigation. But that is maybe a factor. And I think the Twitter, as you indicated, I think the Twitter terms of service say that it does belong to you. It gives Twitter a license to use your tweets. But the issue is what your relationship is with your employer and what your agreement was with your employer, and whether or not there's a term of service of Twitter, I don't think is all that relevant.
Not valid.
When
not
you
relevant.
Get into the dispute between you and PhoneDog.
Let me bring a caller in here, and Bruce joins us. Bruce, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. It's great to hear all the legal advice, but there doesn't seem to be any representation of the sales and marketing benefits of this to PhoneDog. I'm a sales and marketing consultant, and I always look at the bottom line numbers. And 17,000 followers is just a customer service and, like they said, a branding reinforcement exercise. Those people followed Noah because of his expertise at editorializing 120 characters. And the value of that should be measured in whether or not those customers or those PR people brought any business to PhoneDog. And if they didn't, then the entire exercise is suspect from an effectiveness standpoint. So the whole point of this right now is that Noah's created this editorial following, and the company should value that and reward that. But the ultimate value to a PhoneDog remains to be seen.
Okay, let me thank you, Bruce, for those comments. In fact, I'm looking at a web comment where a listener writes in, the account is the intellectual property of the company if the employee was acting on behalf of the company. How is this precedent setting? If a marketer sends out direct mail on behalf of a company, the company owns that piece. Why is Twitter any different? And you would say what to that, Noah?
I would say that nowhere in my work contract did it specify that I was to set up a Twitter account and use it on their behalf. The account was created by me and attached to my personal email address, not to the official PhoneDog address.
But it did have PhoneDog on the
account. It did have PhoneDog in the name. And again, as I said before, when I left the company, I mean, it's petty. I feel silly saying this, but they brought it up first for whatever that's worth. You know, he hit me first. But, you know, they said, yeah, the account's yours. For whatever it's worth, earlier today, you know, another PhoneDog employee apparently, or an ex-PhoneDog employee apparently, stepped up and spoke about the company's social media policies while he was installed as the community manager. So,
well, we're going to hear from more of our listeners on this and continue this discussion. In fact, if you'd like to join the conversation, really some serious legal questions here in terms of social media and privacy, feel free. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Building a Twitter following under an employer's umbrella has become a common business practice. But what happens to that Twitter account when an employee leaves the company? Do they get to take their followers with them, or does the company retain them as social media assets? Oakland-based blogger Noah Kravitz is here with us discussing the potentially precedent-setting lawsuit that may decide this question that he's involved in. He's now editor-at-large of TechnoBuffalo.com, former PhoneDog.com employee. Eric Oldman with us by phone is associate professor at Santa Clara University School of Law and directs the High Tech Law Institute. And Tom McInerney is partner at Ogletree Deacons, a national labor and employment specialty law firm. And we're going to go right to your calls here. But when we were off the air, we're talking about the fact that people at KRON here in town, for example, will put their name on Facebook as KRON and then their name. And Noah was saying that CNN, it's the same thing. You just got, in fact, an email, I guess, from somebody who said, thinking about maybe now removing that CNN from
right,
their name.
Right.
But this does bring up a lot of questions about how social media is used and the privacy of social media. And, I mean, aside from the fact that you got a lot of dog in this race, so to speak, and a lot of money involved, you have some real concern about what this means in terms of just how employees work with their companies.
I do. You know, I'm still fairly young, I guess, but I've been, you know, working as a freelancer, some in publishing, journalism, blogging, and some not for, you know, two decades now, I guess. And when I started out, it was a huge deal to see my name in print in a local, you know, newspaper in the town I grew up in. Now, literally anybody with a web connection and, you know, a working computer can publish, whether a blog or a Twitter account or what have you, and potentially go viral and reach millions of people. And a lot of the people I know in this industry, a lot of people in general in the workforce these days, you know, are going sort of portable. And it's no longer you work for 25 years for one company, you get a gold watch, you retire. You know, we bounce around from job to job, have multiple gigs at once. A lot of people are working as self-employed little independent companies, personal brands, if you will. And so the idea that, you know, as you mentioned before, if a Rick Sanchez leaves CNN and goes to a competitor, or, you know, if a KRON employee leaves and goes somewhere else, you should be able to maintain your personal brand. And also, you know, you and your former employers or your multiple current employers should also all – there should just be a tacit understanding of what is and isn't okay, what you can use, can't use, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, I think the companies have as much to gain from this as the individual employees because as, you know, as one of the callers said and as I think Eric was mentioning, in the cases of – I mean at Techno Buffalo, our president has way more Twitter followers than I do. So let's talk about him. John's followers follow him because of his unique perspective on things. We have an official Techno Buffalo Twitter account. It's kind of a more dry headlines and links, news updates kind of stuff. And then
you've given so much PR to Phone Dog. Now you want to give a little Techno Buffalo.
Exactly. You know, but the case being that, you know, you've got these company branded accounts that tend to be a little bit drier, and then you've got individual accounts. And there's a lot to be gained from social media for any organization to have, you know, individuals who are combining the company message with that personal flair. And it would be a shame to see companies lose out on that because they're, you know, sort of stuck in the past and afraid of embracing and figuring out the right way to work with this new sort of portable employment culture.
But this company is saying, Tom McInerney, $250 a month per follower for 8 months. I mean, you know, how do you quantify value of individual users on any under any circumstances?
Yeah, I'm not. I think it's a difficult thing to do. I think it's probably going to require some sort of expert testimony, but I'm not even sure how you end up quantifying something like that.
Well, Eric Goldman, any ideas along those lines from you?
How to quantify the value of a Twitter follower?
Yeah.
I mean, not all Twitter followers are equal. There are a bunch of fake accounts or shell accounts that go around following thousands of people. Having those as followers is worthless. What really matters is engaged consumers, and Twitter is really just a proxy for that. So I think there's really no way to quantify it because an account is not an account or a follower is not a follower. Can I go back, though, to something that Noah said that bothered me a little bit? Noah said that there should be a tacit understanding about the relationship between the company and an employee who's representing them on Twitter. And that, I think, I would take strong issue with. I think that what we've heard so much about from today is the problems are created when there is a tacit understanding. What should happen, and perhaps happened in this case, but should happen going forward in all cases, is explicit agreements between the employee employer and the employee about the account, what can be done with that account, and what's going to happen when the relationship is over.
You mean contractual.
Correct.
And let me correct. I misspoke. I fully agree with you. I misused the word tacit. I am used to being on video, not on the radio, and, you know, the lack of a TV monitor.
Well, we're much more careful about our language.
Exactly.
Here.
Yeah, I apologize. Well,
and I was going to second what was being said. I mean, that's where you'll end up having problems, is where the understanding between the employee and the employer are not clear. And, you know, when I heard some of what Noah is describing, it all sounded very benign, and I'm sure it has been. Based on its characterization. But the issue becomes when you have somebody, for example, creating a large Twitter following, working for an employer, leaves the employer and starts trashing that prior employer, or starts using trade secret information and disclosing it on the Twitter account. That's where you create a lot of potential legal issues, and that's why I think it's very important that employers have set up like a very clear understanding.
Well, for both sides. I mean, you know, when Noah talks about how everything was pleasant and amicable and so forth and so on, it's his word, her, and their word. You know,
yeah,
it's his
you
and hers.
Know.
I mean,
yeah.
There's nothing in contractual. Let me some serious caveats and lessons in this whole case to be sure. But let me get our callers in. And Brent, you're up. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Okay.
Quick question.
I can't speak for
comment.
All of us, but since you asked,
we're good.
Doing okay. Good. Thank you.
Okay. Comment. First of all, Phone Dog RE is the winner in this thing. I'm smack dab in Silicon Valley. I've never heard of them. I've heard of them. They get a worldwide thing on this. I predict a kind of a happy ending. Everybody will walk from this. As far as anything getting resolved from this potential litigation, this is just the beginning of a long road. And nothing will get resolved from this, but I think all parties at the end will walk away. The Phone Dog's already a winner.
Okay. Thank you for your call. And there's some prescience maybe in that. We'll go to some more calls. Amy, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Hi. So far here we're mainly talking about business and branding and employment issues, but there's actually a larger issue here, and that's free speech. Now, I'm a journalist, and I write about journalism and media for the Knight Digital Media Center at the University of Southern California. That's a project of the Knight Foundation. And this kind of lawsuit, it could happen to anyone who's tweeting or blogging or who's employed by any kind of organization, but I think it's especially ironic that this case came up regarding a journalist's social media account. And that's because journalism, it's a profession that's really fundamentally rooted in the legal and ethical principles of free speech. And that's why journalists aren't licensed by the government, at least in this country. And news organizations, they have a strong conviction regarding objectivity, and that exists for good reasons. But believe it or not, journalists are actually people, too. And as human beings,
that's why none of them can truly be objective. But Eric Goldman... actually, Amy, let me just pick up on your comment, and we'll come back to you in a moment. But I'm interested in hearing Eric Goldman opine on what exactly the relationship this has to journalism, because it does have some pretty far-reaching tentacles there, too, if I can use that octopus metaphor.
I think journalism's a funny industry because intellectual property underlies so much of the relationship between publishers and content creators and distributors. And journalists are often not don't always keep their house clean when it comes to the IP aspect. So from my perspective, the fact that it's journalists involved here is actually probably more likely because they are often less attentive to the legal details about intellectual property. But having said that, I think that the angle here about free speech is worth considering. It's interesting that in some sense, employers do control what their employees say because they are the face of the company. So we have to toss aside our notions of traditional free speech when we're talking about the employer-employee relationship. When we have an independent contractor as a situation here, things just become more complicated, and so let's reserve that.
Amy, did you want to finish up, please?
Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty important issue, obviously, to a lot of journalists, but it's also a really important issue to people who want to get news from journalists. I mean, regardless of the business or political or other sensitivities that the news organizations that employ them might have, journalists have their own things to say. I wrote about this. If you go to knightdigitalmediacenter.org, that's Knight with a K. It's the top story up there right now. But the free speech issue applies to anybody who works for or is associated with any kind of organization. I mean, does your boss really get to limit your free speech? I think that's an important issue. I don't know that that's going to come up in this case because everybody's talking about the business aspects.
All right, Amy, thank you. Good to hear from you. And Tom McInerney, here's someone who put on our website the following question. Don't the followers get a vote in this? If the person you are following is a personality, an expert, somebody you respect or are interested in, you may not be interested in staying with the mother company after the person you're following has moved on. Or even if you are, you may want the option to follow this person where they go next.
Well, true. And I mean, you know, absolutely. And that's where, you know, an employer has to look at it, of the potential risks from this and whether they gain a lot from having somebody like a Noah that posts and has a lot of followers. You know, at the same time, you know, with this issue of First Amendment, I wholeheartedly agree that, you know, there's a fundamental right of free speech. But at the same time, and this will sound somewhat harsh, you don't have a right to free speech at work. Your employer is not the government, and your employer, you know, can control what you say when you're working. They can't control what you say off work or when it's outside of work, but certainly they can control what you say at work. You can't walk down the hall and spew whatever you want. You can't promote things on a company website that is in contradiction to what the company wants to market. And that's where the real challenges come for employers in a situation like this. So absolutely, the people who are following have a vote. They can vote with their feet and decide not to buy the product. But that's somewhat a separate issue for the employer who has to kind of deal with these issues.
Well, here's another web comment. Listener says, just my two cents. If an employee sets up a Twitter account for a company like, say, PBS, and later leaves the company or is let go, the company should retain the account. I would, however, offer some sort of small compensation to the ex-employee for bringing that company into the new age if it was reluctant to create the account to begin with. I would say a fair compensation would be around 10 cents a follower. Okay, there you go.
Again, I think, and I'm going to use the right word this time, I think this is where an explicit, not tacit, an explicit agreement, you know, whatever your work situation is so important. And in my case, when I started with these guys, you know, 6 years ago now almost, we didn't have a YouTube account. We didn't have a Twitter account. We didn't have a Facebook account. All of those things have since become vital parts of their and many media organizations' business. And so we sort of made the rules up as we go along. You know, an interesting thing in our case, and I know this is the case for a bunch of people in my little tech journalism community, started YouTube accounts under a personal YouTube name. So TechnoBuffalo, for instance, John 4 Lakers. He started the account. He's John's down in Southern California, big Lakers fan. Started the account, started making YouTube videos, became immensely popular, one of the top 5 or 10 all-time most viewed channels in the technology category. At a point along the road, YouTube instituted a partner program where they offered to high-performing users the chance to make some money by selling ads on their videos. So John, like many people, accepted, became a partner, then decided to start a business out of this, the TechnoBuffalo business, said to YouTube, hey, I want to change the name because I started this website, TechnoBuffalo. They said, no, you can't change the name because you're a partner and we're already selling against that name and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you have to either start a new site or keep this one. And so this whole issue of name portability, I mean, it's just these rules are being made up as we go along. And you know, as with most things, when money gets involved, if it's enough money, that seems to be when, you know, the issue of something like a legal precedent comes along. And, you know, for the freelancer, for the, you know, like I said, the person who's in media and sort of publishing here, there, and everywhere on your own website, getting paid by somebody else to do it, et cetera, it's, you know, to the point about journalists being a little bit messy with their IP, I don't know if I can speak to journalists, but I know quite a few bloggers who are. It's hard waters to navigate.
Well, here's a listener who says, I create a new business Twitter account for each job. I keep personal and work accounts. Keep everything clean. Another listener says, as a former attorney, I'm wondering if Noah's attorney approved Noah appearing on the show to discuss the issues, or if somewhere on the 280 or 101 Noah's attorney is listening to the show screaming out the window, shut up. Interesting question.
The answer,
how did legal counsel advise you on this? Because you've been all over the media.
Right. So, you know, this the funny thing is this suit has been going on. You know, this battle started back in December of last year. So for a good 12 months now, it didn't, as I mentioned, you know, officially enter the legal system until around July. And being a member of, you know, the blogosphere or a journalist, whatever you want to call me, I've had offers from fellow writers and PR friends saying, hey, do you want to go public with your story? And we didn't. You know, this is an employment dispute. There was no reason to do that. The story was picked up about 8 weeks ago now when we'd filed a motion to dismiss. A federal magistrate judge in San Francisco ruled on that. That ruling became public domain. I believe it was a legal blogger who first picked it up and wrote about it. Then Forbes and VentureBeat picked it up. There was a small wave. Then the New York Times article hit. And so at that point, my lawyer said, you know, given where things were, which I'm not going to get into, et cetera, he said, yeah, I think this is a chance for you to, you know, for you to talk about this. Gave me some points to stay away from.
I would presume. incidentally, if you'd like to join this conversation, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. And Eric Goldman, here's a listener who writes on the web, given the facts presented, does anyone dispute that Noah has the right to close the account without his prior employer's approval? I think that tells us a great deal about who owns the account. As to who owns the tweets he made by an employee, those probably are covered by the presumption created by the employee for hire doctrine under copyright law.
It would be uncomfortable to say simultaneously that the assets created through the account are owned by the employer, but the employee has the unilateral discretion to close the account. I think we kind of have to pick one.
I would love for one to be picked at some point.
Well, one will be picked, probably, unless you guys settle, but I'm not sure which one at the moment. In any case, going back to the close the account, one of the things that if I were an employer I would do is I would always expect to have copy of the password to the account or the credentials to log in. And it baffles my mind when employers have employees who are out there representing the company as the public face, but don't actually have the ability to even log into that account to take over the account if the person gets hit by a bus. So it's not clear to me that the password possession is the right way of measuring who owns the account, but at the same time, any employer who wants to be in control of the account has to have that password, and I'm surprised when they don't.
Let me read another web comment. This is from Scott from Hercules, who writes, PhoneDog's claim of $340,000 damages is absurd. I'm going to follow PhoneDog's new Twitter account with the express stipulation that I'm only doing so on a reference from Noah Kravitz. By PhoneDog's reasoning, they will owe Noah $250 for every month that I follow them, and they have no way to stop me from following them. I'm pretty sure we could get their Twitter account 30,000 new followers by the end of the week that also explicitly state the stipulation Noah will make back that $340,000 in no time. All right, there you go. Let me go to another caller, and that's John from Los Gatos. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm an attorney. I've dealt with customer lists as trade secrets a couple times. And one of the key elements of a trade secret is that it's secret. In this case, the customer list is not secret at all. So if it can't be a trade secret, I'm wondering what kind of intellectual property can it be? It's not a patent. It's not a copyright. What is their position that they own this, that if it's not intellectual property?
Yeah, Tom McInerney, let me just defer to the lawyer
in
the studio for the moment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if the theory is that it belongs to PhoneDog because it's a trade secret or it's a confidential customer list, I think that's a very difficult argument to make. As the caller indicates, one of the factors you look at is whether or not the company has made reasonable efforts to maintain the confidentiality of the list. And it's really hard to say that if it's information that's publicly available to anyone that has a Twitter account. With that said, there are potentially other theories, such as the work for hire, or this is a product that while you belongs to the company that can't be used against or as a weapon against the company. And I think there are ways that an employer can prevent that from happening, even though it's a publicly available list. But I agree with the caller that if it's very hard to argue that this is a confidential customer list. That can
and Noah Kravitz, you were going to say?
I was just going to invite the caller to friend me on Facebook.
Eric Goldman, do you want to weigh in here?
The company has also argued that it effectively owns the password, that the password is the trade secret. So for the trade secret geeks, that's, I think, a more interesting question than the question of whether the follower list is a trade secret, because I don't think there's anyone who could really contend that with a straight face.
Well, here's a listener, David, who says, this seems pretty straightforward to me. Any documents you create as an employee, property of the employer. This is the way that it's been forever with brochures, white papers, et cetera. Why should it be different for online IP?
What if you're not classified as an employee, but an independent contractor with a specific
work-for-hire? Well, that's why your case is even more complicated and multidimensional in some ways. But what about that general statement, Eric Goldman?
Statement is correct that the employer owns the copyrightable works of an employee regardless of an agreement. There doesn't need to be an agreement. That's default law. So in that sense, I think that's pretty clean. But as we pointed out, in many cases, the person posting to Twitter may or may not be clearly doing so within the scope of the employment. And B, when dealing with independent contractors, then, in fact, the default rule is that the independent contractor owns the copyright unless the agreement states otherwise.
Forgive me if this sounds a little bit naive, Eric, but doesn't it seem like sort of a natural for mediation? This case?
You know, let me broaden the point, which is the thing that baffles me the most about this case and the other cases in the this family. As I said, we've seen some others over LinkedIn accounts and Facebook accounts, is that none of this makes any economic sense. Put aside the ridiculous argument about followers being worth $250 a month. In the end, the economic value of controlling an account with Twitter account with 17,000 followers, all of whom can leave if the content isn't what they're looking for, is not worth the legal fees that are being invested to try and grab the account. So it seems to me PhoneDog will end up paying, even if it wins, the $250 a month in fees to get the Twitter followers just because they had to spend on their lawyers to try and take over the account.
And again, Eric Goldman is associate professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law and directs the High Tech Law Institute. And Tom McInerney is a partner with Ogletree Deakins. Tom, listener Zach says, the case with police officers, cell phones, texts being property of the department over in Oakland would seem to have bearing on this case. Do you know that case?
They do. Yes, I am familiar. There's been a lot of litigation, a number of court cases, including on the West Coast and recently in the U.S. Supreme Court, dealing with the issue of privacy and ownership and who controls text messages sent by police officers, but also in the private workforce. And that's as we've discussed, the default is generally that it does belong to the employer, but it gets much more problematic when you have employees using their own personal devices, their own iPhones, their own cell phones and the like to do things related to work, and it gets much more difficult to control for an employer if then there's ultimately abuse, which, invariably there is going to be. I mean, I'm sure Noah's not, but there are a number of employees that would then end up abusing and either are harassing employees or using trade secret information and the like or disclosing trade secrets. And that's why it's really critical that any employer, police, government agencies, but also private employers, have clear policies and make it clear to employees that they know what the rules of the game are. Because if they don't, then you get into litigation like this and it gets to be very difficult to control.
That's the real lesson, I think, of this whole hour for both employers and employees. I mean, make sure you have it in writing, as they used to say. But I keep finding myself intrigued by this whole idea of valuation of $250. I mean, how do you value what a LinkedIn is as opposed to a tweet?
I believe my attorney in the hearing to dismiss the case, I believe it was him, Kerry Kletter is his name, who made the argument. I want to give credit because it wasn't my argument. If you took this valuation, $250 per follower per month, and you applied it, sure, I have 17 now. I have 24,000 followers, something like that. I have a modest following as these things go. If you applied that valuation to Lady Gaga or Shaq or Justin Bieber, you would have – this is the third time I've used this in 12 hours – you would have the gross domestic product, larger on a monthly basis than many nations on Earth. I mean, it's staggering. Get to somebody who has millions of followers and apply that 250
Isn't
per month.
Isn't Kim Kardashian the first on that list?
Right, and I don't want to put a weight on Kim's value to our cultural milieu, but you know, it's
obviously immeasurable by any standards. But we're talking about something that's going to come down to case law in terms of valuation, aren't we, Tom?
It is, and it really will turn on the underlying facts, and an expert is going to have to look at it and look at what value the company has gained from having these Twitter followers, and whether or not these are actual customers of PhoneDog, and what value having this following brings to PhoneDog. And you know, it may be very different for a company like PhoneDog versus, you know, some celebrity who actually is, maybe it's just much more, you know, existential. You're not really sure what value other than notoriety that they're gaining.
No, but companies hire those celebrities and ask them to tweet. I mean, if they've got a million followers on Twitter, those companies will say, right, we have this line, we right, sign you right. to a contract, you're advertising this line for us, therefore we want you to bring in all right. your Twitter followers, and they do.
Right, and actually that touches on an issue that we haven't really addressed, Michael, and that's there are actually FTC guidelines that require that if somebody is promoting a product as a spokesperson, and it could be on TV, it can be on Twitter or the like, they have to identify themselves as actually being paid or promoted or employed by that entity. And oftentimes when you have people doing Twitter, you know, that is not directly tied to the company, it does create some potential legal liability. And that's one thing. I don't know what PhoneDog, it sounded like that it was clear from your post that you were working for PhoneDog. But if you weren't actually working and it was all yours and it wasn't very clear that you were actually working for PhoneDog, PhoneDog could face some legal liability by the,
sure.
by the feds.
And even beyond that, in the, you know, in the tech industry, so much of what we do, our news, is product driven. And we get offered all the time, you know, review product loaners are part of the game. As I mentioned, you'll get a new cell phone to review ahead of time. But we get offered, you know, take this stereo system. It's yours. Just write about it. And that's the sort of thing that, I mean, that's a whole other issue.
Well, there's a brave new world ahead, for especially for the lawyers and all this. thank you, Noah Kravitz. Noah Kravitz, now editor-at-large of TechnoBuffalo.com, former PhoneDog.com employee. And as we said, we invited PhoneDog and they declined. Eric Goldman, Associate Professor of Santa Clara University School of Law, Director of High Tech Law Institute. Thank you, Eric, for being with us this
hour. Thank you very much.
And Tom McInerney, Mayor of San Anselmo, we'll mention that first, partner in Ogletree Deacon's National Labor and Employment Specialty Law Firm. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Mark.
And thank you, our listeners. Another hour ahead, Richard Rhodes, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, will be with us in the hour ahead to talk about Hedy Lamarr, once known as the most beautiful woman in the world, but also an inventor. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.